proceed to the second case of the day, Arlen Gulf versus the Village of Arlington Heights.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please,
Williams.
May it please the Court, I am Joseph
this
Williams.
One second, Mr. Williams, will let the counsel depart. So we... You may proceed, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honors. As I was saying, I am Joseph M. Williams. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiffs in Arlen Gulf to argue this case. And I assume that the Court is familiar with the factual background to some extent of the case, so I thought I'd get right into the arguments. Essentially, the defendant's briefs pointed out, which I agree with, that the issues before the Court are simple and straightforward to some degree. They're not that simple, but they are straightforward, the predominant one being whether the trial judge properly applied the bar of res judicata and issue preclusion to dismiss the initial complaint, the civil rights complaint, of these plaintiffs with prejudice upon the defendants. There's three sets of defendants here, and they all filed 12B1 and 12B6 motions to dismiss based upon res judicata. Now, the basis of that claim was that this particular case before the Court today was filed on March 27, 2009, and was focused upon conduct which we alleged and feel was an abuse of the government's power and discretion and was involving threats to my clients to force them to deny their constitutional and civil rights. The prior case, which was used for the res judicata, was a case that was filed in 2006 in the state court, which was essentially a one-issue matter, which dealt with whether or not the TIF District Number 4 of the Village of Arlington Heights, which was implemented in 2001, I believe, July, was lawfully applied and lawful on its face. That was the only issue in that case. Now, the particular matters as they continue, the res judicata that was applied was not applied in a manner that we feel was lawful in that it's an equitable doctrine. And the case law that I've cited profusely in my brief states that it is to be applied only in a fair and just manner. And in this circuit, this particular court has held, it may be not applied at all where there would be a due process violation or it would be fundamentally unfair to apply it. And we feel that in this case it would be fundamentally unfair.
How much did your clients pay for the center in the first place?
They paid, I believe it was around $800,000 or something like that. They originally took it over. It needed extensive remodeling.
How much did they put into it after they bought it?
Oh, a lot. They put in at least $700,000 into the remodeling. And they had originally talked to the village in approximately the beginning of 2002 and said, we want to remodel the center and rent it out. Is that okay? And they said, yeah, there's no problem. But after they put in the $700,000 or so and remodeled the center, they were told within 3 months after they'd spent all this money, oh, by the way, we're going to TIF this property. And by telling them that, they ran off all the tenants, and through a period of 7.5 years, the village refused anyone else to rent it because they told them your business isn't going to be properly placed.
They got paid, what, $3.5 million, though, for the place?
No, they got paid $1.6 million when they had appraisals that it was at least $2 million, and they at one time had an offer they probably could have got $2.9 million. But it was sold at a short sale, strictly under the market price, to the village. You know, one of the key points in this case, while the defendants argue, oh, this is really just an outgrowth of the same operative facts based on the TIF district, it's totally different. There's a distinction between a civil rights case and a TIF case. And they're totally distinguishable, and particularly in the fact that this TIF was never applied. That's one thing that the defendants have never really dealt with. The fact is, the village came in and said, we are going to TIF your property in 2002. And they told everybody that, and even said at times, we own the center when they didn't, and they did that for 7.5 years. But they never TIFed it. They never did. They just said, we're going to, and therefore, because that threat was hanging over the center, it couldn't be used, it couldn't be rented, but my clients had to pay $15,000 a month carrying charges and the various taxes and so on and so forth and costs to keep the center for the time that they couldn't use it. So it eventually drained them to where essentially they're going to end up bankrupt. And they had no choice but to be overborne from the threats of the village to take the village's deal or be ruined financially. The village, of course, exercised, in our opinion, a great deal of duress. And it wasn't just duress based upon finances, but they told them, if you don't do what we say, we're going to ruin you, we're going to put you in the street, we're going to slit your throat. The village attorney will slit your throat if you try to sell the center to someone else. And if you don't, we are going to take the center for $800,000, and then you're going to have to pay the difference between what you owe and what, you know, we condemn it for. So, I mean, this was governmental abuse that shocks the conscience. And 30 years of practice and doing many, many cases before federal court and this court in civil rights matters, I have never seen more egregious governmental misconduct. But in any event, this case...
Didn't they know that the TIF was a distinct possibility when they bought the center?
No, they didn't, because that was a matter that the village...
That deteriorated and all that.
Well, actually, we would say that it wasn't really that deteriorated. The main problem was it had bad leases and bad tenants, and it wasn't properly managed. My clients had interest, each of them, in separate centers, all of which had no vacancies and ran on a very financial footing that was very equitable and very good. But they had no problems with any center but this one, where they were interfered with substantially by the village's activities. And I think their business acumen was very high, and this was interference to the extent that it caused them to lose millions of dollars over the period in issue. But, you know, the initial state case that res judicata was based on was, again, the applicability of an ordinance. And was this ordinance constitutional, and was it properly applied? Our case is civil rights, and there's also Seventh Circuit and federal authority that there's a complete distinction between federal civil rights cases and eminent domain type of a case. So in this case, we are based our allegations on misconduct, and misconduct going back for years, and a lot of the misconduct took place years after the filing of the state case, so it couldn't have been raised in the state case. A great deal of the discrimination when it came to fruition took place in 2008 in September, when they were threatened by the village agents and various entities that have all been described at length in the complaint. So we filed five 1983 claims and ancillary claims, and we don't feel that res judicata was properly applied because we never got a day in court. We never got due process, which is one reason why res judicata can't be applied. It's also been mechanically and technically applied, which is also not to be done in the case of res judicata, which is never to be applied if there's fundamental unfairness or injustice, which we feel is clearly on the face of this matter. Their constitutional rights have been clearly violated, which is totally different from asking for money from a TIF case, which was the earlier case. I would note that one of the main things also for res judicata is an identity of issues, identity of parties to the privies, and that there was a day in court and a determination on the merits. Now, we feel that there was never any determination on the merits, in great part because the settlement agreement that my clients entered into to dismiss the state case, which is what the defendants rely on to say, hey, res judicata applies because this is a judgment on the merits, which it would be, just a dismissal, if it was voluntary. But it's our opinion that it was totally involuntary and that my client's wills were overborne by the threatening behavior. They were told.
Didn't Mr. Williams, the order represent that the plaintiff's complaint against the village is voluntarily dismissed with prejudice?
Yes, it does, Judge. But settlement.
Wasn't that prepared by counsel?
Well, may I respond to that, Judge? They settled the case and voluntarily dismissed it, true. But they did it in response to the same threats that they sold the center for a short sale and less than its actual value. Prior to their agreeing to do that, they were subject to the threats of the village attorney, the village agents, and their will was overborne because they felt that they would be ruined financially and destroyed if they didn't agree. And the agreement was part and parcel of the bad conduct of the village. That was one of the things they did as far as the duress and overbearing their will, was forcing them to settle the case. The settlement was not voluntary. And as your honors are aware, a settlement is in effect a contract.
Wasn't the main threat allegedly the threat of foreclosure by the bank?
Well, it was not so much a particular threat of foreclosure. They said, we're going to ruin you. We're going to put you in the street. It goes beyond mere financial pressure because it goes to threats. And we're going to slit your throat. And they've already, don't forget, they've been bled for years. So they're on the verge of bankruptcy as it is. They've had this property empty for 7.5 years. They've been told you can't rent this. People that would come in would want to rent it, and they'd be told, we're not going to give you a business license. We don't want your business here. And not to mention, businesses that were treated favorably were given money from the TIF district to go elsewhere. But these plaintiffs were denied any access to any TIF money or any aid at all. And I think they were definitely treated differently, as well as deprived of due process, which implicates the 14th Amendment violations that we've pled in detail. And we have one of the key cases that we rely on is the Piagenti versus Ford Motor Company at 397 Illap 3rd 887, where they, it's a 2009 case that states clearly that res judicata should never be applied when there's fundamental unfairness or an unjust result is worked. And we feel that's exactly what's happening here. The Illinois Supreme Court, in the case of Novak versus St. Rita High School at 197 Illinois 2nd 381, also states that res judicata is to be only applied when there's fundamental fairness and only sparingly.
Mr. Williams, do you want to save some time for rebuttal?
Oh, yes, Judge, I do.
Well, I mean, it's your time, but...
Okay, Judge, I will...
No, you're into rebuttal, but if you want to use the
okay,
time...
Okay, Judge, yes, I will save time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Siegel.
Before I argue, I have to tell the court, I've been the village attorney of the village of Arlington Heights for 49 years. I've never threatened to slit anybody's throat. This is a fantasy. The village never threatened these people at all. We adopted a TIF designation on July 1, 2002. These folks challenged 4 years later, while there was another case going forward, which ultimately the appellate court in Illinois decided our TIF district was correct. These folks filed a suit in 2006. In 2008, we offered $1,600,000. I'm talking about the village, because I represent the village, and I represent the mayor, and represent Mr. Enright, the planner. That was our top appraisal. This is obviously a case, no good deed goes unpunished. We don't know what the business of the bank was here. Apparently they were threatening foreclosure. But that certainly had nothing to do with the village. We did absolutely nothing to threaten these folks. We did nothing except designate a TIF district in which 30 acres were designated, and this one small shopping center was included in the district, which now the Appellate Court of Illinois says is right. Judge Carr properly granted our motion. He granted the motion because under the federal law, which follows the state law, the three elements of res judicata were proven. The plaintiff in the 2006 state case was the LLC, who was controlled by the individual plaintiffs in this case, as well as the LLC, who is the plaintiff. There's no question about privity. There's no question not only that all the issues were litigated with respect, or could have been litigated, and were claimed in the state case, including an allegation of taking, violation of the 14th Amendment, which is the constitutional claim Mr. Williams attempts to raise. Those issues were determined by the decision of these plaintiffs to dismiss this case with prejudice because we were willing to pay the appraised value, which apparently was more than they paid for this place. Now, the court properly applied res judicata. And I cited in my brief Hagee, which I know very well, and Welsh versus Johnson makes it perfectly clear. And the Judiciary Act and MIGRA, the Supreme Court decision, MIGRA, applies the Judiciary Act in a 1983 case. So when counsel says that there's been some problem here as far as res judicata, there is no problem at all. This court has repeatedly held preclusion, res judicata, state court decisions which were decided on the merits. And this was a case which was dismissed with prejudice. We didn't force them to dismiss the case. They didn't have to dismiss the case. They chose to dismiss it because they got $1,600,000. Now, the mayor, who's sued in this case for no reason, is a member of the legislative body, therefore has absolute immunity. Mr. Enright, obviously under Harlow, has at least qualified immunity, and the trial court so held. The village of Arlington Heights saved these folks by paying them $1,600,000 for a dilapidated shopping center, which they bought knowing that this property was going to be included in the TIF district. And when the council says this has never been TIFed, it was TIFed by inclusion in the ordinances which adopted the TIF district in 2002, and the allegations in the state case reflect all that. And that's all in the record.
How many TIF districts does Arlington Heights have?
Five. The only one that's ever been litigated. The others, I hope the court looks at Arlington Heights. It's been a huge success. We're so proud of what we've done in Arlington Heights. So the trial court was absolutely correct. This is barred by res judicata, and the individual defendants are entitled to immunity, and this case is a fantasy.
Thank you, Mr. Sayo.
Thank you.
Mr. Greenwald?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Greenwald, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Village Bank and Trust and its CEO, Mike Polansky. Mr. Siegel, I think, just eloquently articulated our res judicata argument, and we adopt his arguments. So rather than repeat the same arguments, I'd like to address some of the points Mr. Williams addressed during his argument. To begin with, Mr. Williams said his client's state court case was filed in 2006, was a single-issue case. It addressed only the TIF district and the propriety of the TIF district. Well, it's just not so, Judge. If you look at count three of the state court complaint, the amended complaint, which can be found in Arlington Heights Supplemental Appendix on pages 26 and 27, the allegations are that the property owners were unable to lease their property as a result of the conduct of Arlington Heights, and they actually raised civil rights claims. The allegations are that the village's activities constitute a constructive taking under Illinois law. They also raised a constitutional claim under the Illinois Constitution for a takings issue. So the other issues that they seek to raise in this case and sought to raise before the district court could have been raised in the state court prior to the voluntary dismissal in 2008. Mr. Williams also mentioned his view that res judicata is an equitable doctrine, and we agree with that. And in fact, in this case, the equities favor applying the doctrine of res judicata. The defendants should not be subject to serial suits for conduct arising out of the same occurrences. And the plaintiffs in this case should not be allowed to settle an existing action, reap the benefits of that settlement agreement, and then turn around less than a month later, after the closing of the sale of the property, and file the same claims again in federal court, adding some claims, but they all arise out of the same transaction and set of operative facts. Mr. Williams also mentioned that the plaintiffs, in his view, could not have brought the claims they now sought to bring in the district court because the conduct occurred in 2008. Well, that's just not the law. All of the conduct about which the plaintiffs complained happened before they dismissed their state court action in September 2008. And that is the operative date that for res judicata purposes. If you look at whether the transactions that give rise to the current case occurred before the dismissal of the prior case. And in this case, all of the conduct, again, the plaintiffs are complaining about occurred prior to the dismissal of the state court action on September 18, 2008. Mr. Williams also expressed his view that there's been a denial of due process, and there was a denial of due process by the state court. Again, we just believe that's just simply untrue. The plaintiffs in the state court action voluntarily dismissed their case with prejudice. And as Your Honor pointed out, that voluntary dismissal was entered by their counsel. There was no denial or action by the state court that deprived the plaintiffs of their day in court, as Mr. Williams put it. They are the ones who took the action to dismiss that pending lawsuit. And under Illinois law, it's clear. A voluntary dismissal with prejudice is a judgment on the merits for purposes of res judicata. Finally, I wanted to touch on the duress argument. The first time we heard about duress in this case was in the briefs. The complaint doesn't mention the prior state court action, certainly doesn't allege that it was the judgment in the state court action was the result of duress. But in any event, it doesn't matter. Under Illinois law, the state court judgment remains valid. There is a procedure under Illinois law. If you seek relief from a state court judgment, you have to file a petition to vacate it under Section 2-1401 of the Illinois Code. No petition to vacate has ever been filed. Therefore, under Illinois law, the applicable law for res judicata purposes, the state court judgment remains valid, and the district court had no choice but to accord that judgment full faith and credit. Unless there are questions, that concludes my remarks. For the reasons we've stated in our brief and today, we request that the district court's ruling be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwell. Mr. Spallis? No, one more counsel, then it's your turn, Mr. Williams.
Good morning. I'm Michael Chavalis. I represent the realtor defendants here. That's Jack Whistler and the Bryan Properties. There are some fundamental issues with respect to the assertion of economic duress. Would it apply in a situation as an exception to the res judicata principle? A plaintiff has not cited any case, nor has our research found any case that applies economic duress as an exception to the doctrine of res judicata. What plaintiff is attempting to show that he didn't have his fair day in trial, the case law that is applicable by this court has to do with whether or not there were minimum procedural requirements of due process were met. That's the exception that this court has recognized with respect to the application of res judicata. There are no facts that would come within the ambit of that principle because, as Justice Cudahy mentioned, or Justice Kane, I'm not quite sure which one of you did, but said that wasn't there plaintiff's own counsel obtained the order of dismissal. Yes, it was. It was the law firm of Mutch Shellis who obtained that. Actually, the timeline involved in that was there was negotiations back and forth, and the village made several proposals of settlement, and that finally was started out at 1-4, and then it went up to 1-6, back and forth, and the plaintiffs accepted it. But before they accepted it, they had their counsel go into court and vacate it. I mean, enter the judgment of settlement, and then they accepted the order. Now, that's sometime in 06. They never filed any petition to vacate that in the state court claiming economic duress. Fast forward, their timeline is they then proceed to effectuate the settlement agreement. The settlement agreement has to do, they took about 3 or 4 months for the real estate contract, and then the closing occurred a couple more months after that, and then they got paid out in March of 09. From the time of dismissal of the lawsuit to the time of the payout was about 6 months. No petition for vacating that judgment was ever made. They filed the lawsuit 3 weeks later in federal court, claiming that they were violated their rights under the Section 1983. I represent the brokers. My client went in. He was asked to get more of a price. That's what he did. He got into this relationship when the village offered him offered the plaintiffs 1-4. My client got him up to 1-6-1. Where did our clients go wrong? What do we do wrong? The plaintiff files his lawsuit now because he has seller's remorse. He wants a new deal. He wants to keep the proceeds of the settlement, and then he wants to go further on and claim additional damages. The fundamental rule in this court with respect to the exception to res judicata is that they did not have a full and fair opportunity to live its claims, and that minimum procedural requirements of due process were never met. There's been no facts alleged in the complaint or in the response that shows or established that minimum procedural due process requirements were not complied with. In their response to the motion to dismiss, plaintiff says, well, I have a lot of things, and I can assert more if necessary, if need be, to the responses to the village and the response to the bank. They never filed anything with respect to that. The fact of the matter is, how could they when they voluntarily dismissed the lawsuit pursuant to a settlement agreement? So how do they get around that? He had the opportunity of 6 months, several months in the state court, and in the federal court he didn't do it as well. Now, when we get to the issue of economic duress, none of the cases that I've been cited would support the claim for economic duress, even if it would be applied as an exception. What the facts show is that this was a voluntary arrangement. Yes, there was hard economic conditions that were there, hard bargaining, if you will, but hard bargaining has never been considered economic duress. That you're subject to financial pressure has never been recognized as economic duress. I think I'm out of time. Am I?
Not quite, but not you're quite. Not constitutionally mandated to use it, Mr. Spells.
Well, you know what they say, Judge. One more question. The village offer was on September 3, 1-4. The village offer 1-6 was September 17th. The court order is September 18th of 08. September 24th, they accept it. And then the real estate contract is November 3 of 08, and the payment closing is March 4, 09.
We have those dates.
Now we're done.
We're done now.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Savalas. Mr. Williams.
Well, as a matter of fact, I said the presumption of ratification based upon not doing anything after the state court was dismissed. It's clear that was this case was filed in the same month as the closing of the center. There were no funds exchanged until March of 2009, and this case was filed in a matter of days after that in the same month in the same year. And I would point out to this court that during both of these counsel's arguments, we have continuous denial of the well-pled facts of the pled complaint, which is extremely extensive. I forget how many pages. It's something like 75 pages of facts. And the thing is that they're denying the duress. They're denying what they threatened. You cannot deny that on a motion to dismiss. That's a factual motion. On a motion to dismiss, you must accept the well-pled facts as true. And they don't. They are denying them. They're trying to say they never happened. Their fantasy.
That if you plead economic duress, you can always defeat a 12b6 res judicata motion.
Not necessarily, Judge. I say that you can in this case because res judicata has exceptions where there's denial of justice, fundamental fairness, or due process. It doesn't have to be applied, and it is not to be applied in a hyper-technical and mechanical fashion, which I think this particular trial judge did. And in this case, an offer you can't refuse was made to these plaintiffs. I say that's not voluntary, and we all know that a contract to settle a case is a contract.
Well, you have here...
It's a contract defense.
We have relatively sophisticated parties on both sides, represented by able counsel.
Well, I don't know the prior counsel myself, so I don't know how able they were. But on the other hand, I think that my clients, from my information, did not settle the case voluntarily. They did so because their will was overborne, which we have pled, and I think has to be accepted as true based upon the fact that the only thing before the court is the legal issue and not the factual. The rest is, in fact, a factual issue, and I've cited in my brief case law to that effect. And since it is a factual issue, I don't think it's proper to be even discussed whether or not it actually took place without having any evidentiary hearing. So the dismissal was, in our opinion, of the state case, a gun-to-the-head dismissal, and the sale of Arlen Golf was not an arm's-length transaction in good faith. And the taking by the TIF was not actual a taking, but it was a threat. It was an ongoing threat that never manifested in the actual taking, so that we believe it's at the most a constructive threat to TIF, and it definitely does not arise out of the same operative facts. Most of the threatening behavior that ended up in the sale of the shopping center took place in 2008. Now, how could we raise that in 2006 case? It couldn't. So the prospective application of res judicata wouldn't apply to anything between 2006 and 2008. And one of the purposes of 1983 and the 14th Amendment is to prevent the government abuse of its power and misconduct. And I think that misconduct and abuse is apparent here and is from the pled facts ongoing. And to say that there's no case because a single issue on a different set of facts without the bad conduct and threats precludes this action, I think, denies my clients the day in court, which they never got.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.